Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, was so good and so imposing, and they really held mastery of the skies over Europe. And in October of 1943, we were losing 50 or 60% of our bombers on every mission, and it was just a slaughter. It was apparently a crying need to get a long-range, high-performance fighter in there that take the bombers in and take them out.
An excerpt from one of today's guests, who reveals the little-known story behind the rise of the P-51 Mustang, the fighter plane that allowed the Allies to rule the skies over Europe in World War II. Authors David and Margaret White are here, and I'll speak with them right after this break. I'm Robert Child, and this is Point of the Spear. Gift-giving season is here, and for the military history lover on your list, check out my book about the Black Medal of Honor recipients of World War II. Immortal Valor chronicles these timeless heroes' life journeys through all the pain and struggle until their ultimate triumphs. I hope you purchase the book or audiobook, which is available now in stores and online. Welcome back. Today's guest, David White, studied history at Harvard and worked as a reporter for the New York Times. Margaret White is a freelance researcher and editor of nonfiction book projects about scientific breakthroughs and how they have changed the course of history. Their book is called Wings of War, the World War II fighter plane that saved the Allies and the believers that made it fly. David, Margaret, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Oh, it's such an honor. I didn't realize there was such a fascinating story behind this aircraft, a story behind the story. What got you both interested in writing this?
Well, actually, I guess it started with me. My dad, who's now about to be 103, was a ground officer with the 20th Fighter Group in England during the war. And when I was a little girl, he told me stories of the arrival of the P-51 and how it had changed everything for the 8th Air Force. I began to read and realized that this was absolutely true, and had the idea to get David, who had written previous books, to do this book with me. It took a little convincing because he had only written about military ships and never about military airplanes. But I worked on him, and we got started, and that's how it began.
Margaret read about this for years based on the story of her father, and finally came in and said, what do you think about it as a book? And she told me the story of the Mustang, and I said, it's absolutely a book. We have to write it. I had written two previous books and many magazine articles for national magazines, and I had written all my books about ships in the sea, and this was a new branch for me, but a very exciting one. In my youth, I had been a reporter for the New York Times covering shipping. So as I say, it was a new enterprise for me.
Yeah, quite a change from shipping to aircraft. I understand there was a great need for this aircraft in the war. Could you tell us why it was developed?
First of all, the bombers were having terrible trouble in 1943. And people don't generally understand it, but we really almost lost the war in 1943 because the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, was so good and so imposing, and they really held mastery of the skies over Europe. And the bombers would go in, and none of the fighters that existed had long-range capability. The fighters would all have to turn back at the coast of France, and the bombers would go in and just get slaughtered. And in October of 1943, we were losing 50 or 60% of our bombers on every mission. And it was just a slaughter. And it was apparently a crying need to get a long-range, high-performance fighter in there that take the bombers in and take them out to protect them from the German armory.
And, of course, the planning for D-Day was already well underway. But Eisenhower and his colleagues realized that no invasion of France was possible if the Germans continued to have air superiority. We couldn't get the guys on the beach. We couldn't get them across France. It wasn't going to work.
You have to remember that at this point in 1943, there was no land war in Europe. The land war didn't start until D-Day, which was almost a year later. And the navies were useless for striking at Germany. I mean, you couldn't strike at Germany from the middle of the sea. And the air power was the only weapon that the Allies had to really strike at the heart of Nazi Germany. So it was very important that the air war succeed, and the success of the air war ultimately turned around this long-range fighter, the Mustang.
And of course, the Allies did have fighters. The problem right. was that none of them was any good for getting in over Germany. The B-47 had a short range, had to turn back at about the German border. And the B-38, which was a pretty good plane with longer range, had terrible engine trouble. In fact, the 8th Air Force lost more P-38s to engine failure than were shot down. So they were really without a good fighter that could take the bombers all the way in.
I see. And this plane came in 1943?
Well, that's the story. It was, in fact, designed in 1940 for the British RAF when the British and the French were coming to us for arms early in the war before we got involved, designed in California by a German emigre. But the Air Force, for various reasons, obstructed the plane's development from its appearance in 41 when it was built until very late in 1943. The Air Force did not want to get behind it. And we talk in the book about the reasons why we think that may have happened.
Mm-hmm. And at this dark point in 1943, when tens of thousands of young men were losing their lives in these devastating raids, the bureaucracy in the Air Force Materiel Command was resisting adopting the Mustang and kept insisting that bombers should take care of themselves and didn't need fighter protection. So there was a real almost scandal about the Army Air Force's reluctance to adopt the Mustang. And then finally, late 43, they did.
Sounds like too much bureaucracy to me.
Yep.
And politics as well, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And politics and possibly corruption.
That's a given.
Fellows on the ordering side who were taking crap from other aircraft companies to make their planes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who were some of the driving individuals behind this effort? Who larger than life character that actually got it across the finish line?
The designer was a fascinating figure, Edgar Schmood. He had been a penniless boy in Germany. His father was very poor and couldn't pay for Schmood to go to college. And Schmood gave himself a homespun education, and educated himself in engineering. And then he went through various stages, and finally, this penniless waif from Germany reached the top of his profession, designing the P-51 Mustang.
And we talk about how Ed Schmood literally grew up with aviation. He was born in the year 1900. Of course, the Wright brothers took off from Kitty Hawk in 1903. So he, as a little boy, was aware of all the early developments and very much excited about them. In fact, when he was 12, he saw one of the Wright flyers crossing Germany on its way to Russia. And that was apparently the moment when he decided that he had to design airplanes. So he started drawing them and even built his own flyer after World War I. And made his way finally to California in his 30s to North American Aviation, which was then asked by the British RAF to design a fighter. And when that happened, he had the design apparently in his head.
Wow.
Yeah, he had been thinking about this for so many years.
Talk about Tommy Hitchcock for a minute, Margaret.
Yeah, Tommy was the guy who decided as the air attaché at the U.S. Embassy in England that he was going to push this airplane. He had the vision to see that it was exactly what the Allies needed. He arrived in England in the spring of 42 Just as the British RAF had taken delivery on the original Mustang, the P-51A, and he was hearing about these fabulous tests that the airplane was having. And so he went to his boss, the American ambassador, Gil Wynne, and persuaded him that they should get behind this plane. And they began to lobby literally everyone in the then growing 8th Air Force in England that they could get their hands on. And when they realized they weren't having much success, he just took off for the States and stayed over here, crisscrossing the country for a number of months, talking to Air Force officials, talking to the press, until he finally began to turn the thing around. And that was Tommy Hitchcock. The interesting thing about him was that he was a New York socialite, and he was a world famous polo player who had who loved to fly, had flown in World War I. He was an adventurer.
He was an achiever and a success story in many, many fields. He was thought to be the greatest player of polo in world history. He had studied at Harvard and Oxford. He had made a fabulous fortune for himself as an investment banker at Lehman Brothers. And he had been a very successful World War I fighter pilot. And he was kind of a standout colossus who was very well known. His obituary was run on the front page of the New York Times. And he was sort of this dazzling figure of New York society, and became, as Margaret says, the real champion of the Mustang when it was going through this time of rejection by the U.S. Air Force.
Right.
And the sadness, the tragedy was that when the Mustang ran into some trouble right before D-Day, some mechanical problems, he decided that he would test it because he was the one who had pushed it. And he crashed in the plane and died before D-Day could take place. And so he missed the triumph that he had put in place.
It sounds like there's a good biography there.
Yeah, there has been one written, in fact.
I hope you're enjoying this episode. Next time, Marine combat veteran and author Ben Kessling will be here to discuss his new book, Bravo Company: An Afghan Deployment and Its Aftermath.
I realized that there was a lot more to be done and a lot more to be said with sort of the narrative arc of a soldier's experience. And so I went back and I wrote Bravo Company. And I did that by following these men. I followed them from their training and workup to their deployment in Afghanistan. But I don't think that there's a lot of books that then trace that arc back to the United States when people come home.
Another reason to click that follow button to be notified when the episode releases. And before we return to the conversation, if you're enjoying this aviation story from World War II, check out our earlier program with retired Air Force Colonel Mark Vlahos and his book, Men Will Come, A History of the 314th Troop Carrier Group, 1942 to 1945.
There's so much written about, you know, the 8th Air Force and the bomber crews, but the troop carrier men, you know, who wore this patch, you know, right, the airborne troop carrier patch, and the glider pilots, you know, who dropped the paratroopers and flew aeromedically vac and combat resupply missions. Most people don't, there's not much written about them. So I felt I needed to fill this void in history.
It's show 129 from season one, and you'll easily find it in our past episodes.
The third person we profiled centers around Colonel Donald Blakeslee, who was the guy who really got the Mustang into the front line of long-range bomber escort. And Blakeslee was quite a character. He was your prototypical Type A maverick fighter pilot, hard-charging, hard-living. It was said he could drink all night and fly all day. He was considered one of the best group commanders in the U.S. Army Air Forces. His fighter group, the 4th Fighter Group, shot down more planes than any other fighter group in the 8th Air Force. They shot down 1,016 planes. Wow. And held the record for most Nazi planes shot down.
The problem was when the Mustang arrived in England, the
P-51B with the powerful Merlin engine that the Air Force generals, even though they had ordered it, still didn't believe in it as a bomber escort. And so they were assigning it to the 9th Air Force for strategic flying. And Blakeslee was, I guess, the first 8th Air Force pilot to fly it. And once he did realize the potential that it had. And so he started, much like Tommy Hitchcock, at a different level to push this plane in England with his superiors until finally they gave him some Mustangs and he began to fly missions with the plane with great results.
And that's my next question. What was the initial reaction of the Germans to this plane? Was it shock, surprise? What happened?
They were really shocked because they had had a free ride for 3 years and had been very successful in slaughtering B-17 and B-24 bombers. And they were shocked when they saw the Mustang over interior Germany. And Hermann Göring, the chief of the Air Force, said that as soon as he saw fighters over Berlin, that was the moment he concluded they were going to lose the war. So they were really surprised and stunned by the appearance of the Mustang.
What he actually said was, "I knew the jig was up."
Yeah.
Yeah, the jig was up.
The jig was up. And that was in March 1944. So that was 3 months before D-Day. And only about 2 months after the Mustang really started flying over Germany. So it was pretty, pretty quick.
Would you say that that the Berlin raid was its first big mission, first big success?
First big success, but Blakeslee and his boys were beginning to fly the Mustang at the very beginning of 1944. And they were already seeing success. The loss rate was going down pretty quickly, even though they were flying a lot of missions.
In Berlin, there were 660 bombers that went in. 69 were shot down, about 10%, which was a vast improvement over the 40 to 50 to 60% loss rates of the dark time in the air war. So the Berlin raid was a considerable success. And we shot down 56 German fighters and fighter bombers in the Berlin raid. So in terms of loss rates, it was a big success. And in terms of German planes shot down, it was a big success.
How did it, was it utilized in D-Day?
It covered the troops and was essential in bombing railway tracks and railroad marshaling yards and highways. The Germans later said that the attacks on highways and railroads prevented them from moving reinforcements to the front, and was the reason why they were so defeated at D-Day. So the Mustangs played a big role in D-Day.
And of course, we had already, with Mustang escort for the bombers, essentially knocked out the Luftwaffe by D-Day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Faulty intelligence was showing that we should expect about 2,000 planes over the beaches on D-Day. In fact, the Germans only had about 200 to put up, and over the beaches, if you can imagine, only two fighters arrived to strafe the troops from the air, which was enormous because, you know, had the Germans come out in force, we could not have landed all those guys. It would have been impossible.
These are two other interesting statistics. Statistics can be an awful war, but these show the stunning effect that the Mustang had. In March 1944 alone, Allied fighters, mostly P-51s, shot down more than twice as many German aircraft as they had in all 1942 and 1943 combined. In March alone, the Mustangs shot down 2,115 planes, which is almost half the German Air Force in that 1 month alone. The 4th Fighter Group in March had 160 kills compared to 120 over all the previous years. So in 1 month, the 4th Fighter Group shot down more German planes than they had in all the previous year. So this thing was really a Trojan horse or a doomsday weapon. Just came in and summarily changed the whole war picture.
Yeah, a total game changer, that's for sure. Yeah. When bringing it to the close, when was the P-51 finally retired? I assume it operated in Korea.
But operate in Korea, and the Air Force found that it could contend very handily with Russian jets with them, and in fact, it had a tighter turning circle than the MiGs, and it could really deal with the Russian MiG jets very effectively.
And we actually saw this at the end of World War II when the Germans brought in the jets that they had developed as their wonder weapon to change the game at the end of the war. What they found was that the Mustangs, although they were slower in the air, could outturn the German jets. So that was the first hint that this airplane had a future beyond the Second World War.
And when was it last used?
It's still being used.
The Australian and a lot of foreign air forces bought Mustangs. The Australian and New Zealand air forces flew them until 1999. And Ron Harker, the British test pilot, who really was the first to grasp the potential of the plane, was allowed to fly the Australian Air Force Mustangs until he was 88 years old.
There's still about 150 in private hands in this country, collectors' items, and about 175 worldwide, plus about 100 Mustangs in various museums around the world, though a few still exist.
It's amazing.
Basically, the Korean War was the last blast for the Mustang. After the Korean War, it was no longer in the Air Force lineup.
The book is called Wings of War, the World War II fight airplane that saved the Allies and the believers who made it fly. David, Margaret, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks.
Thank you, Robert. It was a pleasure.
That's it for this episode. Thank you so much for joining me. Next time, Marine combat veteran and author Ben Kessling will be here to discuss his new book, Bravo Company, an Afghan deployment and its aftermath.
I realized that there was a lot more to be done and a lot more to be said with sort of the narrative arc of a soldier's experience. And so I went back and I wrote Bravo Company. And I did that by following these men. I followed them from their training and workup to their deployment in Afghanistan. But I don't think that there's a lot of books that then trace that arc back to the United States when people come home.
Another reason to click that follow button to be notified when the episode releases. And if you like what you hear, leave a review or a rating or just click the follow button. And be sure to check out our Point of the Spear YouTube channel with bonus video material plus full military history documentaries. There's tons to explore. I hope you check it out. I'm Robert Child, and this has been Point of the Spear.
Music licensed from audioblocks.com. Point of the Spear is produced by RSC Media Group.